Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
As I said just a few minutes ago, we are tonight going to be examining Mormonism in its present form as a major religion in the world and surely as a significant presence in American life. And the immediate occasion for that is perhaps, though I've always been interested in the question of what the Mormons really believe, what they really do, who they really are, but the immediate provocation of the question, I suppose, is the success so far of Mitt Romney in the Republican primaries, the possibility that we may shortly have a Mormon as president for the first time. My guests tonight are Manya Brashear, an old friend who does wonderful religion reportage for the Chicago Tribune, and with us on the on phone, two other guests, namely Jana Rees and Patrick Mason. Jana Rees is a converted Mormon. She's the author of a number of interesting books. Most relevant for us presently is a book she published 6 or 7 years ago titled Mormonism for Dummies. And our other guest is Patrick Mason, who is a lifelong Mormon, a birthright Mormon, one might call him, and now heads Mormon Studies Center at Claremont Graduate University out in Claremont, California. So, Jana, good evening.
Hello.
And Patrick, good evening.
Good evening.
And let me come instantly to a very basic question in my mind. There are all sorts of things that ordinary Americans think they know about Mormonism, and they're platitudinous, though possibly true. Yes, we know that once they practice polygamy, actually what anthropologists call polygyny, and then they gave it up under strong pressure from the federal government. We know about the great march to the West as led after the death, after the assassination, in fact, of Smith, the founder. We know that we hear lots of jokes about Mormon underwear, not worth talking about at the moment. We know that in the Great Temple in Salt Lake City and probably in other temples, there's a procedure by which non-Mormons already deceased are somehow made into Mormons so as to save their eternal souls. What I think most Americans, most non-Mormons don't know is the doctrine of progressive, of the progression towards godhood and the Mormon conception of who our God is. And I would ask you instantly, Jana and Patrick, to explain that to the world.
Who the Mormon God is?
Well, who God is as Mormons conceive him.
Well, I think that the understanding of God would be recognizable to many people of the Abrahamic faiths, the idea that God is a creator, that God is the father of Jesus Christ. Those are very important beliefs to Mormons. I think that one thing that would be considered different, especially from evangelical Protestantism, is the idea that God is having a physical body. I think many Protestants have that as a very blasphemous idea that God would have a body of flesh and bone. That's what Joseph Smith taught.
Yes, but you still have left one important thing out. Let's see whether Patrick brings it in. There's another fact about God.
Well, I think part of the core of Joseph Smith's teaching, especially late in his life, was essentially that God and human beings are fundamentally the same species, that they're not essentially different, that human beings are literally children of God, and so because of that, they can grow up in an eternal sense and to be just like God and to do the kinds of things that God does.
And indeed to become gods.
And exactly, and to become gods themselves. Not
To become gods on or for other planets. Is that the representation of it?
Well, there's some speculation about where this might happen and so forth, but the bedrock doctrine is the sense that they will become gods and do the same kinds of things that God does, namely, you know, create and have a kind of eternal perfection and glory about them. It's not to displace God as he is, but to essentially inherit the kinds of attributes and glory that God now has.
And you are a birthright Mormon, whereas Jana is a convert. Did you have any trouble with that doctrine, Jana, before you came to full conversion?
Well, sitting here listening to Patrick, by the way, hello, Patrick.
Hi, Jana.
I haven't seen you since you went to Cairo, so hello. You know, I just last fall wrote an article for the Christian Century in which I went back through recent general conference talks, general conferences when Mormon leaders speak from Salt Lake City twice a year, and they are basically expounding upon doctrine. I was not able to find any recent mentions of the idea that human beings are going to become gods. That doesn't necessarily mean it's no longer part of Mormon theology. It is exactly as Patrick has said, in its classic formulation. That is how it was taught in the 19th century. But I think that for contemporary Mormons, that is not one of the more operative beliefs. Contemporary Mormons, when they are thinking of the afterlife, are much more likely to talk about eternal families, being reunited with people that they love, than they are to talk or speculate about planets and...
In the afterlife, for the ordinary Mormon family, if they're good people, they will be somehow restored to physical existence and will have... The man and woman will have sexual relations. The kids will be there. Do the kids go on growing, or do they remain eternally children?
Again, we are venturing into some very speculative territory here that is absolutely not what animates Mormons. This is something that you certainly read in 19th century formulations. I would be hard-pressed to find any kind of recent statement
Who was Milton R. Hunter?
Milton R. Hunter. You're going to have to go to Patrick for that one. We had Howard W. Hunter, who was a prophet of the church. Is he a relative?
Well, Milton Hunter is identified in something I've got in front of me as a member of Mormonism's First Council of the 70. Wrote a book titled The Gospel Through the Ages, but I don't see any dates, so I'm not sure. Do you know Patrick?
Right. So the First Council of the 70 is one of the governing councils or quorums of the church, and so Milton Hunter was a member of these, and so was an ecclesiastical leader, and this is what you'll find within Mormonism.
How far back would that be?
I believe it's early to mid 20th century.
Uh-huh.
I can't give you an exact.
Well, let me give you a quote from Milton R. Hunter, who says Mormon prophets have continuously taught the sublime truth that God, the Eternal Father, was once a mortal man who passed through a school of earth life similar to that through which we are now passing. He became God, an exalted being, through obedience to the same eternal gospel truths that we are given opportunity today to obey. And it goes on, of course, to offer that famous couplet or bit of doggerel, as man is, God was, as God is, man may become. Which summarizes very effectively the notion that all men, and it's men, not women, are capable of rising to godhood and will have ultimately, can have as much power, as much exaltation, as much eternal significance, and will generate as many millions or an infinity of spiritual children as does the God who happens to rule over us.
That's right, and that's a powerful idea that comes out of, especially out of 19th century Mormonism, and a lot of Mormons today would be really motivated by that idea, that this idea that we're essentially the same kind of being as God, and that we can progress to become like Him. There are Mormonism is a diverse religion, just like any others, and I think Jana is absolutely right. You could go to a Mormon congregation for a month of Sundays and not hear that kind of thing talked about. It's not that people don't necessarily believe it, but it's just not formative in their weekly worship lives and so forth.
I've monopolized so far. Let me now turn you over to the gentle hands of Manya Brush here.
Well, Patrick and Jana, good evening.
Good evening.
I wanted to ask about, I mean, we're talking about the doctrine, I hope I get this word right, of theosis, right?
Yes.
And it's shared by other Christian traditions, although perhaps interpreted differently. And Jana, I've heard you use the term 19th century formulation. Are we talking about how the doctrine was interpreted in the 19th century and how that may have evolved over the years?
Well, you know, Patrick said something which was great right there at the end, that Mormons have this idea of eternal progression. And throughout Mormon history and to today, that is still a very powerful idea in Mormon theology. What I was objecting to was all of the speculative specifics about having planets or having sex or, you know, nobody knows anything about that. And so that's just not something that is commented upon today.
Mm-hmm. And is this at the heart? I mean, I know that, the Trinity is defined differently by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and that that really is at the core of the contrast between other Christian teachings and Mormon teaching. Can you describe that a little bit more and go into that a little more?
Sure. You know, in classic Nicene Creed Christianity, the Trinity as Father, Son, and Holy Ghost is the great mystery, is that the Trinity is three in one. And so even though these are regarded as unique members of the Trinity, they are also entirely united in purpose and in essence. Basically, ontologically, they are united. And in Mormonism, they are united in purpose, but not in essence. And so that may seem like, you know, angels dancing on the head of a pin, but to a lot of people, that's a very important idea. Joseph Smith thought that these were three separate personages and taught that rather than being united as a single Trinity, three in one.
Mm-hmm. And that's really where Mormons and evangelical Christians, many of them in the Bible Belt region where a lot of these primaries are taking place, that's kind of the theological clash, right? Is that kind of the heart of the theological clash there?
That's definitely important. You know, and it's interesting, too, because my husband, who is Episcopalian, I went to his church to this wonderful group about reading the Nicene Creed, and we went line by line, week by week through the Creed. And it was very surprising and interesting to me to find how many Protestants in that group had questions about the Trinity or didn't understand it. I don't know that Mormons understand how these personages function as three separate beings, but that is what is taught.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We need to look at something of the history of Mormonism and its beginnings. We're hearing some strange signals. I don't know what they are. I trust the engineering department can clear that up. But we right now must pause for a brief message.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we return directly to Jana Rees and Patrick Mason, and in studio with me, Manja Brashear. No one told me. I'm not quite clear. Where are you at the moment, Jana, and where are you, Patrick?
I'm in my office at Claremont Graduate University in Southern California.
And because I know both of you are involved in a big conference on Mormonism and American politics to be held just a few days from now at Columbia, isn't that right?
I won't be there.
I am going to be part of that. I'm a co-organizer for that conference. It starts on Friday, and we have a dozen scholars looking at Mormons and politics throughout American history.
So are you in New York tonight, actually?
I am. In fact, as a sort of bizarre coincidence, the lyricist for the Book of Mormon musical, I just ran into him on the street, Bobby Lopez, so that was fun. He's a wonderful guy.
Now let's
see someone you know in New York.
Let's talk about the origins of the Church of Latter-day Saints. And it has everything to do with Joseph Smith. What is the story that is told and accepted by all Mormons as to the actual origination of their faith?
The basic story is that Joseph Smith, as a young boy in upstate New York, he was a teenager, 14 years old, he's confused by the proliferation of faiths around him, mostly different evangelical Protestant denominations. There were major revivals that were sweeping through the United States and through the area at the time. So Joseph Smith was confused about which of the churches he should join, so he turned to the Bible, which was the source of religious authority at the time, and he read a passage that told him he could pray and ask God, and that God would answer his prayer. And so he did that. He went to the woods near his home and prayed, and he reported that he saw a pillar of light, and in that light, God the Father and Jesus Christ came and visited him. They told him that he should not join any of the churches, and that started a series of visions for Joseph Smith. Mormons refer to that as the first vision. And that started a series of visions. His next one was 3 years later when he saw, was visited by an angel named Moroni. He was visited periodically over the next few years by this angel. And eventually he was shown where these, in a hillside near his home, where a cement box was underneath a stone, and he uncovered it. And there he found golden plates, which were the record of ancient peoples of America, which he translated into the Book of Mormon. That, in a nutshell, is kind of the basic history of the origins of it. And with the publication of the Book of Mormon, it was published in 1830. Immediately thereafter, he organized the church and then went from there.
And the Book of Mormon for Mormons has the status of revealed truth equal to what one finds in the Old and the New Testaments.
That's correct. Mormons consider the Book of Mormon to be on par with the Bible. They consider it to be Scripture, consider it to be the Word of God. And of course, that's a claim that other Christians also find objectionable, because they consider the Bible to be the full revelation of God.
And the Book of Mormon tells us that there was a great continuing struggle or war between two opposed groups in old America long before it was discovered by Europeans, and that these were, in fact, the remnants of the lost tribes of Israel. And in the midst of that war, Jesus, who has been crucified and resurrected in the Holy Land, shows up now. But is this earlier or after his crucifixion? Shows up in America and brings peace and brings truth to the warring tribes.
That's soon after his crucifixion and resurrection in Jerusalem, as related in the Bible.
So it's his second coming.
Mormons refer to the second coming as the coming that hasn't yet happened.
Yeah.
But it served his second coming in the sense that it was after his appearance and life in the Holy Land.
Now tell me, as good Mormons, both of you, Jana and Patrick, and you are intellectual Mormons, you're both very active. John is a very active journalist who's done a number of fine books. I've got a more recent one in front of me titled Flunking Sainthood. And Patrick is a university-based academic with a PhD. You both got PhDs. Are you required to, and do you in fact require of yourselves, to fully believe the Joseph Smith story about the discovered golden plates and the angel Moroni and so on?
How do you define fully believe? As factual, literal history, all of it?
Yeah,
how would you define that?
I'm asking whether you take that to be factually the case, factually what really happened to Joseph Smith.
Well, I would say that there are some complexities with the story. You know, the story that Mormons will teach today has Joseph Smith being 14 years old at the time of the first vision. In reality, there were several different versions of that story in the 19th century, and he is different ages in different stories. In one, it's just God the Father appearing to him. In another, it's God the Father and Jesus Christ. So when we talk about, do you fully believe this, it's important to define what it is we are assenting to. I would say that, yes, I do. I'm a believer in what Mormons would call the restoration, and what that means is that in some way, God had this message for Joseph Smith, which came forward in this time in American history in particular, but it was for the world. And the particulars of that, you know, may be debatable, but something happened so that this message would be brought forth.
And Jana, you know, some people have distinguished for me between orthodoxy and orthopraxy, mm-hmm. and how Mormons really approach it. You know, orthodoxy, of course, being, you know, belief; orthopraxy being practice, and that the practice is really in the living the standards and high moral standards of the faith is really what's important to people in the tradition. Would you agree with that?
I would. There's a tremendous emphasis on how what you believe informs how you live your life, and whether you have certain issues or questions about different tenets of the faith is less important than whether this religion and these teachings are transforming your life. Are you being charitable? Are you a loving person? Are you caring for your family? Are you healing the world? Those are the operative questions.
One of the books that Patrick Mason has done is titled The Mormon Menace, Violence and Anti-Mormonism in the Postbellum South. I think that's published by Oxford University Press. Am I right?
That's right.
That title brings to mind the very important and persisting question of why there's been so much anti-Mormonism in American history. After all, Joseph Smith was literally shot down in Nauvoo, Illinois, and that's what began the Great Trek to the West. There's been much anti-Mormonism preached from evangelical pulpits at times, even to this day, I'm sure. What do you make of that?
Well, I think, anti-Mormonism is as old as Mormonism. And from the very beginning, the Joseph Smith publicized his claims of new revelation and new scripture. There were people who opposed it. And I think that's fair enough. I mean, in an American marketplace of competing religious ideas, religious groups have always opposed one another and said the other group is wrong and we're right and so forth. And so I think to some degree that's all fair enough, especially when representatives of different faiths actually try to get the story right. But there was always, and there developed very early on, a nastier and more violent strain of anti-Mormonism. And it was partly because Mormonism didn't necessarily operate like some of the other denominations at the time. Mormonism, as it evolved, it wasn't just limited to the theological sphere, but Mormonism, especially in the 19th century, and things have changed since then. But in the 19th century, it made political claims, it made social claims, it made economic claims. Eventually, the particular doctrine and practice that brought upon it the most violence and hostility was, of course, when it developed polygamy and when it announced it in 1852. And that really, as you mentioned earlier, really brought the heavy hand of the federal government and people across the country. And so it was a wide range of things, but it persisted for several decades, that violent strain of anti-Mormonism.
What is the status of anti-Mormonism today, would you think?
Today, I think it still persists, but it's almost entirely on a theological realm. And you don't see Mormon missionaries getting killed today like they were in the 19th century. The federal government isn't passing laws to try to disincorporate the church like it did in 1887. So it's actually because of that harsh anti-Mormonism, when Mormonism was forced to give up some of its more particular practices, such as polygamy, such as economic communitarianism and other things. And it did that at the end of the 19th century. So the story of the 20th century and Mormonism in 20th century America has largely been one of integration, one of accommodation, where still there are competing theologies and different theologies. But for the most part, even its opponents and most strident critics will say, will it begrudge the fact that, yeah, Mormons are good, honest, hardworking, patriotic Americans. They're the kind of people you want to have as a neighbor. I just don't believe what they believe.
Still, one hears some rumblings of anti-Mormonism at the political level in response to the emergence of Mitt Romney as a likely candidate for the presidency. I wonder whether we're going to get with Mitt Romney something of what we got with JFK from fundamentalists and evangelical preachers who were very concerned about a Catholic running for the presidency of the United States. We need to discuss that further, of course. And indeed, JANA's conference about to convene in New York is, I gather, concerned with Mormonism and American politics. We'll turn to all of that right after we pause for an update on the news. For that, to the WGN Newsroom and Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
My guest tonight, as we are doing something of an overview of the Church of Latter-day Saints in American life and also as it bears upon American political process, what those guests are: Manya Brashear, who is the religion reporter for the Chicago Tribune; Jana Reese, who is a converted Mormon and the author of many books, including one titled quite directly, Mormonism for Dummies; and Patrick Mason, who is a professor and the chairman of the Mormon Studies program at Claremont Graduate University in California, and the author of a number of books, one of them being the one I referenced earlier, The Mormon Menace, Violence and Anti-Mormonism in the Postbellum South. Manya, what is your understanding of the extent of, in terms of sheer number and sort of in the census of who the various members are, of the Mormon Church in the world?
You know, to be honest, Jana would probably, or Patrick would probably be the better people to actually give that census report. But it's certainly one of the fastest growing religious traditions in America. And I want to say, guys, please correct me. The number 5 million is jumping out in my head, but I'm not really sure what that number is for. Jana, do you know?
Yeah, there are 5 million Mormons currently in the United States, okay, and 14 million around the world. So the 5 million figure represents a little under a third of the Mormons around the world.
Okay. And in terms of, I mean, there have been some articles recently that have been published about attrition in the church as people are, you know, delving deeper into, as we were just discussing before, the beliefs of the church and the history of the church. Some of them are finding and discovering some troubling facts that they didn't discover late in the process. And there have been some articles recently about them walking away from the church and the church trying to address that. Jana and Patrick, you may have some thoughts on that in terms of how real and how genuine those reports of attrition are.
It's hard for us to know in terms of numbers because the church, although it does fairly extensive social and demographic research internally, it does not, unfortunately, release those figures to the public. I can tell you anecdotally that I do believe that there is a lot of foundation to those reports. I have observed attrition. I am interviewing people for a book I have coming out several years hence on growing up Mormon and the idea of how does retention occur and why does it occur. And I think that there are a couple of factors at play here. One of them is not about Mormonism at all. It's about what's going on in American religion more generally. We've seen a 100% increase, essentially, in the rise of the nuns, by which I mean not N-U-N-S, but N-O-N-E-S. Sociologists are using that term to describe Americans who claim no religious affiliation when they're surveyed. They say they are no religion. That number has gone from 6 to 7% to about 14% overall in the American population. And among young adults, it's as high as a quarter or even a third. So this is a trend that's very likely to continue. So Mormonism is certainly part of this larger sea demographically in which we are all swimming. But I think internally, there are issues that are specific to Mormonism as well. And we've touched on a couple of those. And, you know, I have a desire to see the church be more transparent about its history, to update some of its curriculum and manuals, especially for youth, because they are very out of date. And nowadays, all kids have to do is go to Google, and in 30 seconds, they're going to find some of these questions, and they're going to go to their parents and say, why did you never tell me these things? Why did I never learn about this in church?
Mm-hmm. Are they people who are growing up Mormon who, in your research, that are walking away, or are they converts who maybe were introduced to the faith by a missionary, joined, and then learned some of the troubling thoughts? Okay.
It's definitely both.
You know, one thing we haven't handled is the actual name of the church. Of course, Mormon is a term that Mormons for quite a while resisted and thought to be rather pejorative. The official name of this religious body is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Would you explicate the very name of the church as a way of further clarifying the nature of its own conception of itself?
Sure.
Why the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints?
Right. I mean, fundamentally, and this is one thing that the Mormons are insistent upon, is they say it is the Church of Jesus Christ, that first part of the name is really important, too, and that it is at base, you know, if you go to Mormon worship services, read Mormon scriptures, listen to Mormon sermons, they're deeply Christian in the sense of focusing on the life and teachings of Jesus Christ. The second half of the name, Latter-day Saints, is more of a temporal designation in terms of setting the church apart from what it would consider to be the former day saints or the church that Jesus established when he was on the earth. A core part of Mormon belief is that Jesus established a church when he was here. He called 12 apostles, but that church fell away, went into apostasy, and so that precipitated the need for a restoration, as Jana mentioned earlier, which was brought about by Joseph Smith and is represented in the current church. So the sense is that all the members are saints, and this is the way that early Christians referred to one another as well. So all members are saints, and it's simply in the latter days as opposed to the former days.
Another matter of theology and of doctrine. Jana made clear earlier that you don't have the triune concept of God. This is not a Trinitarian version of the Christian faith. Now, and we've got God, the concept of God, clearly, and of Jesus as his son. Only begotten son, I guess, wouldn't work in Mormon parlance, because apparently God, at least as the father of spiritual entities, is the father of millions or of an infinity. But is Jesus equal in theological status to God the Father, or is he somehow otherwise?
Well, he's certainly, and Mormons do refer to Jesus as the only begotten Son, and similar to the way that Christians do, and Jesus is with the Father in the Godhead, as Mormons refer to it, and so Jesus is considered a fully divine person as well as human when he came here to Earth, and so Jesus is worshipped, Jesus is praised. Mormons believe the salvation comes through Jesus. So it does get a little tricky, as Jana mentioned, once you separate them out and now say that you've got three beings instead of one. But Mormons do say one of their fundamental articles of faith is that they worship the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. They just consider them to be three separate beings.
We need to pause once again briefly for a round of commercials, and then I want to get to something which I signaled earlier, but I haven't yet let you talk about, namely Mormonism in the context of American politics and American politics right now. We will be directly back then to Jana Rees and Patrick Mason and Manya Brashear after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And let's get onto the political dimension or the various political dimensions as we return to Jana Rees and Patrick Mason. And here's a direct question along those lines for Amanya.
Yeah, we were talking about the anti-Mormonism earlier and how in the 19th century the doctrine of polygamy fueled a lot of that. But I'm also curious if it was Joseph Smith's own presidential run that kind of escalated the anti-Mormonism in that period, and also whether there is a fear that Romney's candidacy and the political rhetoric that goes along with that is going to be steps backward for the church.
Now, along those lines, to begin with, what do we know about the actual history of Joseph Smith's presidential run?
Well, I know that he was in Nauvoo, Illinois, actually, when he ran for president and then was later assassinated in Carthage, I believe.
That's right.
Yeah, that was obviously the end of his presidential run, but it was also the beginning of the move west, because that was when the Mormons were essentially driven out. They were driven out of Illinois, forced to cross over a frozen river and head for Utah. Right.
That's right.
But Patrick, did Smith actually attempt a serious national campaign?
He did. He tossed his hat into the presidential ring in 1844, partly because he felt like neither party was addressing the very real human rights abuses that the Mormons had suffered in Missouri. And so he said, well, if none of you will take care of us and none of you will take care of religious minorities and other persecuted peoples, then I will. And so he did. He declared himself a candidate. He sent out missionaries who doubled as political agents to spread the word and get his campaign going. I don't think there's any way he was going to win. Some people have speculated he could have been a destabilizing force, as some third-party candidates have been, like Ross Perot and others. But he was a serious candidate. He took it very seriously, and he had a political platform and so forth. I think his presidential run was less of a factor in his ultimate assassination as other things. But certainly the church's political claims in Utah, as Brigham Young set up his government. He was both governor of the territory and a prophet and president of the LDS Church at the same time. Certainly that kind of conflation of church and state really irked a lot of people, and that contributed to much of the anti-Mormonism in the 19th century. In terms of how it plays now, the situation is just very different. I mean, Mitt Romney is very clear that he holds fast to the American doctrine of the separation of church and state. A lot of his statements along those lines are very similar to what John F. Kennedy said in 1960, and I actually see a lot of parallels between the two. Mitt Romney gave a talk in 2007 on the topic that echoed a lot of what Kennedy said in 1960. So certainly I think this has brought to the surface a lot of lingering anti-Mormonism and fears of an imminent Mormon theocracy. But actually, I don't think that's any kind of serious threat at all. Mitt Romney's not at all interested in that. The LDS Church certainly isn't interested in that. This is just a very different church than existed 150 years ago under Brigham Young.
Let's examine Mormons in political office. Actually, there have been quite a few at the national level. How many are in the Senate at the moment? Four or five at least, isn't that right?
Yeah, something like that, yes.
Who are they? The two senators from Utah, to begin with.
That's right, and then of course Harry Reid is the most
famous from Nevada.
Majority leader from Nevada,
yeah,
and a Democrat. Gordon Smith is he still in office from Oregon? So there are a handful, and of course quite a few in the House as well.
And we've had various cabinet members who happen to have been Mormons. One of them, way back, was Ezra Taft Benson, Secretary of Agriculture. I forget which presidency that.
Under Eisenhower.
Under Eisenhower, right.
Who later became president and prophet of the church, correct?
So he did.
That's right.
Yeah.
And my understanding is that actually caused a little bit of tension or discomfort, you know, to kind of combine that marriage of his political role and his religious role. I mean, he separated the two. When he was doing one job, he was only doing that job. But that was part of the tension, or part of some tension in the church in terms of making sure. That's why there's such an emphasis now on the church being politically neutral in the context of this campaign. Yes or no?
There were some definite concerns when Ezra Taft Benson became the president and prophet of the church. In the LDS Church, it's very well organized at the top. You always know who is in line to be the next prophet because it's the most senior apostle. So the person who has been in the Quorum of the Twelve for the longest tenure will be the next prophet. And people were sort of looking ahead and seeing that Ezra Taft Benson was going to succeed Spencer W. Kimball, who was one of the most beloved prophets of all time. And a number of people were very concerned because Ezra Taft Benson not only had really married Mormonism to the Republican Party by serving in the Eisenhower administration, but he also was a very strong proponent of the John Birch Society, which is an extremely conservative political group. And not all Mormons are Republicans. Not all Mormons feel that way. But, you know, in his defense, when he was the president and prophet of the church, politics was not the main agenda. His main agenda really was getting members of the church to read the Book of Mormon more, building temples around the world, and expanding the missionary force globally, making Mormonism a global faith.
Mm-hmm. It is more or less expected of all young Mormon men that they spend a year, or is it 2 years, in missionary work?
2 years.
And they go in pairs, usually. They knock on doors any place between here and Kuala Lumpur, I guess.
That's right. I mean, anywhere, in any country that will let them in, and there are some nations that don't allow for Mormon missionaries, but and young men and women go as well. They have no choice in where they go. They send in their papers, and then they can be sent anywhere in the world.
So what was your missionary career, Patrick?
I went to the very exotic locale of Seattle, Washington.
Uh-huh. For 2 whole years?
For 2 years, and I wore the white shirt and the black name tag and knocked on doors and rode bikes and did the whole thing. It was a very formative experience for me.
What is the Mormon way of life? We know that there's a taboo on alcohol and on caffeine. I don't know how you get through life without drinking coffee or tea. Explain that to me. This is maybe a trivial question, but it really bemuses me.
It's not trivial right now. It's almost midnight my time. And I have 4:30 in the morning.
But you will not have any coffee, will you?
No.
Why not?
Well,
I can understand a prohibition against.
It's called the Word of Wisdom, which
yes.
is the Mormon dietary law. And the idea is that certain activities will have a better benefit on our health and well-being than others. Coffee, I think, is a more recent interpretation. There's plenty of evidence that members of the church in the 19th century drank coffee, and in fact it was listed as one of the provisions when you
uh-huh.
went west. But now the expectation is that members will not drink caffeinated coffee, caffeinated tea, etc., and also no tobacco products, no alcohol, What am I missing here, Patrick?
Drugs, of course.
Right, no drugs. That should go without saying, except by prescription from a physician.
And it's also hot drinks, right? Because I remember for some reason there was some distinction made in the code for hot drinks, but you can drink Pepsi or Mountain Dew. Is that a myth?
No, you're right. In the 19th century, this was interpreted differently. The phrase hot drinks is what is found in the Revelation. In the 19th century, that may have referred to a hot alcoholic drink. It's unclear. But what's important is that the way that the church interprets it today and teaches it today to members is hot drinks, except you can have herbal tea and you can have hot chocolate.
Hmm.
A little confusing.
That is confusing. The Pope of the Roman Catholic Church can, if he chooses to speak ex cathedra, offer judgments which are classed as infallible and become, in essence, instantly verified doctrine. Is the same true for the president prophet, the head of the LDS Church?
Yeah, we don't usually use the word infallible. That's not really part of
the
I know
you don't, but does he in fact have essentially the same cognitive superiority?
Yes, and in fact it can be even stronger than that because the belief is that he is a prophet of God, similar as we had with Moses and Elijah and any of the other Old Testament prophets. And so that the messages that the prophet delivers can be considered as coming from God. Now, the prophets have said that not every word that comes out of their mouth is straight from God, and oftentimes what they're giving as they speak to members is kind of general counsel and moral teaching and so forth. But there is a clear belief. I mean, Mormons are quite serious when they say that they believe the president of the church is a prophet of God and can receive revelation from God.
And one revelation that was received only, I guess, within the last 30 or 40 years was that, after all, blacks can be admitted to full significant membership in the church. Whereas until then, from the church's founding up until that date, whatever it was, black males could not attain the status of priesthood within the church.
That's right. And that revelation came in 1978. I think it's one of the most significant
developments. To whom did it come? Who was the...
The prophet was Spencer Kimball.
It was Spencer Kimball
that Jana mentioned earlier, and many Mormons think who were alive then say, I mean, you know, they remember it just like other people remember when you know we landed on the moon or when JFK were shot. I mean, they will tell you exactly where they were. I mean, this was something that ordinary Mormons hoped for a long time. But it is true, and actually, I think this is one of the tragic chapters of Mormon history that for. During Joseph Smith's lifetime, he actually did ordain African-Americans to the priesthood. There weren't very many black members, but they did hold the priesthood. And so it was a later development. And for about 125 years, African-American men didn't receive the priesthood. They couldn't go to the temples. It really is a tragic story. I mean, a lot of the statements that Mormons made aren't that much different than what other white Christians made in America. That certainly doesn't make it right. But certainly 1978 marks a watershed for Mormonism becoming a truly global faith and opening its door to people of all people of all races and so forth.
In my first and only visit to Salt Lake City many years ago, I was giving a lecture at the university, not Brigham Young, but the other one, I guess just the University of Utah.
Perhaps.
And I had then I was interested in poking around. I went down to Temple Square and to the building for visitors, and fascinating material. Heard not a live concert, but a recorded concert by the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. And full of the spirit of things, having left, I walked up to the temple itself and sort of attempted to enter. And no door would open. I think I knocked on a door when some kind gentleman came along and said, are you a Mormon? Or are you a Latter-day Saint, I think he said. And I said, no. And he explained to me with no condescension whatsoever that I wasn't allowed inside. So I don't know what happens inside. We all wonder. What can you tell us about temple procedures and temple ceremony?
Well, there are several sacred events that can take place in temples. One of them, we talked earlier about families and the belief that families can be together for eternity. And that is a ceremony that happens in the LDS temple. If you are married, as I was, you know, in outside the temple, then that marriage is considered to be binding for life, but not necessarily for eternity. So that's one of the rituals that occurs in a temple. Also, on an individual basis, there's something called washing and anointing, which is kind of like a baptism for the living. There is baptism also for the dead. If you are doing your genealogy and you are bringing names and dates of people in your family to the temple, you had mentioned at the top of the show that this was converting the dead to Mormonism, and I just want to say that that's not actually the way Mormons see it. In Mormonism, one of the primary theological ideals is this idea of human freedom, of agency, as we call it. Agency is the right, the act, right to act for yourself and not to be acted upon. And so Mormons are not converting people. They are making that possible should those individuals in the afterlife choose it. Mormons believe that in the afterlife, everyone continues to make spiritual decisions and that death is not the end of our progress. We talked about that as well. But no, there are no forced conversions here. There are no forced baptisms. And that may seem like a semantic issue, but to Mormons, that's a very important distinction.
We are due for a quick stop for an update on the news. And then directly back to Manya Brashear here in the studio with me and Jana Rees and Patrick Mason. But now to the WGN Newsroom and Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Our focus tonight is on the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons. And we're reviewing some basic facts about their history and their practice and their attitudes, though there's so much more that could be said. And there are some very good books around that convey it to you, not least among them being the one by one of our guests tonight, Jana Rees, Mormonism for Dummies. That's part of that series of all sorts of things for dummies, I gather.
Yes, that's right. It's one of those yellow and black iconic yes. books.
Jana Rees is... you were for many years at the book journal from New York.
Yes, I worked for 9 years as an editor at Publishers Weekly.
Publishers Weekly.
And now I'm an editor just in the publishing industry.
And Patrick Mason is a serious academic. With your PhD is from Harvard. Do I remember that correctly?
From Notre Dame. Actually.
From Notre Dame, and is the head of the Mormon Studies program. He is the Howard W. Hunter Chair of Mormon Studies at Claremont Graduate University. Manya Brashear is, of course, the brilliant religion writer and I would presume to call you religion editor for the Chicago Tribune.
Just a writer.
Well, you have editorial status in my eyes. a word to all of our listeners. We're going to go to the phones in about another 10 minutes or so. We're opening the lines at this instant. The number, of course, is 312-591-7200. 312-591-7200. And for those who are listening over the Internet at some greater distance, including those in other countries as well as on either coast or wherever, if you want to get to us via email rather than by phone, the proper expedient is simply to email us. The address, extension720@wgnradio.com. Extension 720 as one word at wgnradio.com. And again, for phones, 312-591-7200. The lines are open. We await your calls. And more about politics and Mormonism.
Yeah, I mean, the surge of interest in Mormonism is, of course, in the context of the Romney campaign. So I was really thrilled to see you, Jana, co-organizing a conference with actually one of my favorite professors at Columbia University, Randall Balmer, who was actually on this show a couple months ago with me. And so I really wanted you to talk a little bit more about who's going to be featured at this conference and what kind of topics you're going to tackle there this weekend.
And indeed, what are they going to say? What points are they making?
Well, I can't tell you that yet because I haven't heard their papers. But I will certainly let you know if you're interested after Saturday. It is open to the public. If you have any listeners in New York,
we have a few.
It's free, taking place at Columbia University on Friday all day and then on Saturday until 2 p.m. We are starting the conference with a paper on Joseph Smith's run for the presidency in 1844, which we've already discussed here. that's going to be by Richard Bushman, who's the author of the book Rough Stone Rolling, which is probably the best and most comprehensive biography of Joseph Smith. We have University of Pennsylvania law professor Sarah Berenger-Gordon speaking about the rise of the sort of legal team of the LDS Church in the 19th century as they tried to defend polygamy and tried to defend the church from the incorporation that Patrick has already talked about. Someone is speaking about Ezra Taft Benson. Someone else is going to be talking about the history of African-American relations within Mormonism in the 19th century and also how it has played out in the current campaign. Some of the other papers are more contemporary, looking at Mitt Romney's campaigns in 2008 and also the current campaign. And then the paper that I'm probably looking forward to the very, very most is a sociological paper by David Campbell, who's the co-author of the book American Grace. And he's done a lot of demographic research into American religion, both for that book and for the Pew Institute. And we have Joanna Brooks is going to talk about Proposition 8 and the Mormon influence there. Peggy Fletcher Stack, who's a journalist for the Salt Lake Tribune, is going to talk about this current election and how Mormonism has been portrayed, particularly in the print media.
Either you or Jana or Patrick said earlier tonight, not all Mormons are Republicans, thus undermining what is a platitude that is probably held, or a prejudice that's probably held by many Americans, particularly those of the liberal persuasion. But what are Mormons with regard to basic policy intentions as they translate into political identity? Aren't, in fact, most of them on the conservative side and thus more akin to republicanism than to the Democratic Party?
Yes, the rate is a little bit disputed. Somewhere between two-thirds and three-quarters of American Mormons self-identify as members of the Republican Party or say that they are leaning toward the Republican mm-hmm. Party, and then between a quarter and a third of American Mormons say that they are not. So there you are.
And where do you fall, Jana?
I was trying to not go there, but I did just out myself. In the New York Times yesterday, I wrote a piece about why I'm not voting for Mitt Romney. And it's not for the reasons that many Americans seem to be afraid of Mitt Romney, which have to do with his Mormonism, but rather just because I don't share his politics. And his comment today, which I felt was very, well, it lacked compassion, talking about how he, as president, would not extend special efforts to help the very poor. He's not concerned about the very poor. He's not concerned about the very rich. He said he's concerned about the middle class. And that's all very well, but I think that in our country there is more that we could be doing for the very poor.
In fact, does that jibe with Mormon theology, that statement?
Well, I think it does. I think if you had other Mormons on this show, they would probably say maybe not. But there's a very famous sermon in the Book of Mormon by a king named King Benjamin. And really, it comes down to a person's very salvation being somewhat dependent upon how that person has treated the poor and also how an entire society treats the poor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Patrick, how do you identify yourself politically, if you don't mind my pressing directly?
I'm also in the minority on the political left.
Another liberal Mormon.
I am.
Well, that's because
you've got two of us on the program.
So yeah. Of course, that's because you're an academic.
And well, I think that has something to do with it.
Has a great deal to do with it. Now, I'm a conservative Jew and an academic, so you can't predict from those simple sociological variables. When I say conservative Jew, I don't mean I practice conservative Judaism. I mean I'm a rather secularized Jew, but conservative in political orientation. Manja is?
I'm a reporter.
Is a reporter with no political identity whatsoever. We're going to go shortly to the phones and to the email. A quick pause for some commercials, and then your questions and comments to Manja Brashear, Jana Rees, and Patrick Mason. Once again, the phone number is 312-591-7200. I see one line available at the moment. However, if you call and hit the busy signal, don't be totally discouraged. To the contrary, try again directly after we say goodnight to a prior caller. And email is infinitely available, though it may not all of it get read, but I see some good ones that have already come in spontaneously before being invited. Do by all means email us, particularly if you're one of our overseas listeners, especially those on the Pacific Rim who are listening to us after midday tomorrow. For email, extension 720 at WGNradio.com. Extension 720 at WGNradio.com or 591-7200 directly onto your contributions, whether questions or comments, after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we will go now directly to the phones and to the email. 312-591-7200 for your comments and questions to Manya Brashear, Jana Rees, and Patrick Mason. And first up is John. Good evening, sir. You're on the air.
Good evening. Very important public service, and thank you. I'm learning a lot tonight. One or two questions, if I might. Were there any other historical figures who were witnesses to the visions or revelations attributed to Joseph Smith? And my reason for asking is, was it true that Joseph Smith was imprisoned for misrepresentation or fraud involving gold plates before his visions?
Yes. Jana, Patrick, please.
There were no other witnesses directly to Joseph Smith's earliest formative visions. There were 11 other men who signed sworn statements that said they saw the gold plates that Joseph Smith translated from for the Book of Mormon. But nobody else was there in the grove with him for his first vision or when he saw his vision of Moroni. When he had later visionary experiences, there were other experiences when he said that he saw Jesus Christ and had other visionary experiences, and other people did share with him in those experiences, but not for those early formative visions. And it is true that Joseph Smith was brought into court several times during his life, and one of the early experiences in 1826, he was brought for being a disorderly person. He was involved in treasure seeking and using seer stones. It was a kind of a common part of upstate New York culture, but also controversial at the same time.
Was he convicted?
He was convicted at various times of various crimes. In that particular case, it was a misdemeanor. It wasn't considered particularly serious.
Second question: do Mormons consider themselves the true Jews?
Jana, do you want to take that one?
I've never heard that expression used. No, the true Jews
consider themselves to be Jews. Or the, Melton, maybe you can help me with that.
Well, I truly don't know the answer, but there are some special views of Judaism and the history of the Jews to be found in Mormon scripture, isn't that right?
Yes. The idea of the Book of Mormon is that this family has come from the old world to the new and brought their religion with them, and they're trying to stay faithful to this faith, to what they knew in Jerusalem in this new world. The details of that are a little bit sketchy. I think that your larger question about identity is an important one. One of the things that Mormons do, which is a unique spiritual practice, as far as I am aware, is something called a patriarchal blessing. And in a patriarchal blessing, you will go to someone who is ordained in your area for this purpose, and that person will sit you down, put hands on your head, and begin to speak with the idea that this is a blessing that's coming to you uniquely from God. And as part of that blessing, which is a once-in-a-lifetime experience for Mormons, that does not happen at a temple. It actually usually happens at the church or at that person's house. This person will declare your lineage in the house of Israel. And so that's one connection perhaps you were talking about in relation to Judaism. Is that what you meant?
Back to you, sir, the caller. I believe he has hung up. He's been listening,
okay.
But
sorry.
He's no longer interacting. You know, there's a fine brief biography of Joseph Smith I might mention at this moment, done by Robert Rimini, who was a great historian for many years at the University of Illinois here in Chicago. Do you know that one?
Yes, I do. That was part of the Penguin Live series.
I believe so. Mm-hmm. When I mentioned that to Manya, you asked me, was he a Mormon? I think not. Am I right in that?
No.
Not a Mormon, yes. But all the same, very sensitive and appreciative biography of Joseph Smith by Robert Rimini.
One of the nicest things about that book, in addition to its brevity, you know, it's very concise and readable, but because he's a historian of Jacksonian America, it does a really good job of portraying the worldview and what's going on elsewhere in the 1820s and 1830s to help readers understand Joseph Smith in his historical context.
Mm-hmm. Now, back to the calls. Next up is Tom. You're on the air, sir. Good evening.
Thank you. I noticed that statistics and statistical abstracts show that most mainline churches on a per capita basis have been in decline in the latter half of the 20th century. But Mormonism has been a remarkable exception. The aggregate data between 1951 and 2001 shows a fivefold increase in the aggregate numbers of data and a per capita increase of over, well, 2.5 times. So I wonder how much of that is due to differential birth rates and how much would be due to conversions. And I'm especially interested in the conversions because I'm interested to know what social conditions or forces explain American receptivity to Mormonism in the latter half of the 20th century.
Well, a group of related and very interesting questions. Patrick, Regina, go at it.
Sure. Well, it's an excellent question, and you've done your research. And the I would say both factors are at play in terms of Mormons do have traditionally higher birth rates than the larger American population.
How much higher, by the way?
Right now, it's Mormon households are about one person, 1 to 1.5 people larger than other American households. And Mormons traditionally have been about that rate higher. But also, and I think that would have explained it in the first part of the 20th century. But in the second part of the 20th century, the Mormon missionary effort really exploded, and it was particularly emphasized by some of the LDS prophets as really part of the religious duty of Mormons. They'd been sending missionaries out ever since the very beginning, but it's really taken off in the second part of the 20th century, and not just in the United States, but globally. In fact, most of the Mormon growth has occurred in Latin America, now increasingly in sub-Saharan Africa and parts of Southeast Asia, and so the missionary enterprise has been really successful. Jana, maybe you want to say something about the conditions of conversion, especially with your experience.
Sure. I think demographically, Mormon conversion is probably quite similar to conversion elsewhere. It's a combination of attraction to belief and also attraction to lifestyle. And for Mormonism, possibly attraction to lifestyle plays an even more decisive role in the decision to convert. In conversion, and I can speak from personal experience, you know, it's not just that you are gaining something that you think is beautiful and wonderful, but you're also often giving something up. In my case, it was my dream of being a Presbyterian minister. I was in school for it at the time, which, you know, as you can imagine, a little bit awkward. And I think that with Mormonism, the demands that are placed on individuals, we talked about dietary restrictions, missionary service, service to the poor, lots of things, tithing. Surprisingly, those help bring converts. You would think it would be the reverse and that people would flee from a religion that asks so very much of them. But sociological research has actually shown that at some deep level, people are attracted to a religion for which they have to make sacrifices.
Oh, may I continue?
Yes, please do, sir.
Oh, thank you. Well, actually, I was interested. I think what you're saying is really interesting, and I appreciate your answer. But I was curious to know what social conditions or forces explain American receptivity to Mormonism in the latter half of the 20th century. Something happened, and it's obviously not just birth rates. And the other things you're talking about are kind of perennial. They're characteristic of the religion. But what was going on in the latter half of the 20th century to make this remarkable growth in America? Any suggestions?
That's a great question. I can hazard a couple of guesses, but probably nothing definitive. The first would be the overall upsurge of religion in the 1950s. You know, we look back at the 1950s as this golden age of religion, and we think of it as this high point, but in fact, it was an aberration. So you have a period in the early 20th century, especially from the 1920s and 30s, when religion is very much in decline in America, and then after World War II, it starts to surge again. So Mormonism is part of that larger national story. But even if you take it a little bit further than that and into the 1980s, for example, with the rise of conservative evangelicalism. The rise of Mormonism at the same time, and Patrick has talked about especially the global missionary effort in that period of the 70s, 80s, 90s, the rise of Mormonism in that time is not all that different sociologically from the rise of evangelicalism in that time. The rise of the megachurch, for example, interest in this conservative theology that sort of tells people this is how you can understand the world, this is a definitive and comprehensive worldview that you can adopt. People at that time found it very attractive.
The difficulty I have with that is that the other churches have been in the per capita decline throughout the second half of the century. I wanted to know what explains the difference between Mormonism's rise and the decline per capita of these other churches, including Southern Baptists, Methodists, Catholics, Episcopalians, Presbyterians. They're all in decline, and Mormonism is shooting up. That's what I was trying to get at.
Well, some of the evangelical churches surely have also been on the rise rather than on the decline.
Yeah, I am paid for Seventh-day Adventists, and they, too, are in accelerated growth, too.
Yeah.
But I was curious to focus on
the Pentecostal Church has been grew by large, large amounts over the second half of the last century.
If I could jump in here, actually, I've always thought, and I actually have gotten this theory from Remini's book, but you know, the formation, the foundation of the Mormon faith and Joseph Smith's revelations, I've read that it really grew out of an era where people were looking for more stability in the home, more family stability, more stability in the family unit, and I think that has also been the case in the latter 20th century. You know, as the American family has crumbled and has become less stable, the Mormon faith and the fact that it and the lifestyle really offers stability and strength that is hard to find in other places. And I think that maybe that might be that I have, to be honest, I've always thought that was part of the appeal.
And with that, sir, we thank you for the call and for a very interesting contribution. And we are about to pause for another update on the evening's news, right after I say that we've now got one or two lines available at last. So if you've been trying to reach us, make another quick try. Somebody will get through to 312-591-7200. And, of course, also available email. Got some interesting email I will read shortly. The email address, extension720@wgnradio.com. And with that, to the WGN Newsroom and Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we will go now directly back to the phones, 312-591-7200. And our next caller is Jim. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hi, good evening. Does the Mormon Church have a position on, are they pro-life or abortion or neutral or what on this?
Oh, I would guess. Am I right on this, Janet? They would have to be anti-abortion.
Yes, okay, you are right. The LDS Church has a pretty firm anti-abortion stance. There are exceptions made in some cases of rape or incest, but for the most part, the sanctity of life is held as a really key
sure.
value.
And
also made for the life or the health of the mother as well.
Thank you.
And let's go to the next caller, 312-591-7200, and Charlotte joins us. Good evening.
Hello.
Yes, sir. I'm told you're Charlotte. You don't sound like Charlotte.
Charles, right. I heard from a Mormon that God and his wife are making spirit babies, and the Mormon households on earth try to make as many babies so that the spirit babies would have a body to live in.
Well, spirit babies is a very interesting concept in itself. Would you like to clarify that for us, Patrick?
Well, I think that goes back to some of what we were talking about earlier, that some of the actual mechanics of you know, the afterlife and what it means to become like God and so forth, that there has been speculation in the past two centuries of Mormonism. But to be sure, nobody actually knows the mechanics of this. So there are certainly folk doctrines that have risen similar to what your friend has told you. But I wouldn't call that authoritative Mormon teaching.
But you say folk doctrines, but you find them in the scriptures of the church, don't you?
Not anything like that. Nothing specific.
In a pearl of great price, don't you find it in there?
No, nothing as specific as that of God and his wife having babies or something like that.
Well, spirit babies.
It's much more.
Who are then duplicated by actual living human beings who produce them in the standard way.
Certainly, Mormon doctrine is quite clear that we are God's children. Again, the mechanics of that is left to mystery. But certainly that human beings, as they have babies, those children are children of God as well in a spiritual sense.
I've never understood if the family is reconstituted perhaps with some physicality in the afterlife, but it's the whole family for eternity. What happens to the children? Do they never grow up? Do they remain?
They're all adults. I mean, it is one of the mysteries. What does it mean for a nuclear family to be together, but everybody has their own nuclear family? I mean, that's one where Mormons kind of shrug their shoulders and say, we'll let God figure it out in the end.
I see. All right. I'm quite ready to leave that to God as well. 312-591-7200. We've now got a number of lines available. If you've been trying to reach us, make another quick try while I turn to some of the email that has accumulated. And let me see what we have here. Email's rather slow. This one's rather long, so I'll go to another one first. Yes, here we go. A listener in Wisconsin asks, the Mormons state that they are no longer practicing polygamy, yet there is a suspicion that they do still practice it, although through clandestine ways. Please have your guests comment. Of course, one might very well add, there are some other deviant Mormon groups, supposedly, who openly practice polygamy and are now being rather prosecuted and pursued by the federal government.
Well, I think Milt has already answered the question. Your caller, unfortunately, has been misinformed, or your email writer. Members of the LDS Church, by which I mean the one that's headquartered in Salt Lake City and has 14 million members, and the one that we've been talking about for an hour and a half, has not practiced polygamy since 1890, okay? There may have been a few people who practiced it after it was disavowed in 1890. After 1904, those people have all been excommunicated, 1904 issue of the Second Manifesto. And I think it's important. Two things are important. One is that it would be very nice if people took history at its word and said, oh, perhaps it's really true that members of the LDS Church no longer practice polygamy because there's absolutely no historical evidence that that is still occurring. I think people might be harboring this romantic idea that we have a lot more of an interesting life than we actually do. The other thing, though, is that I wish that the LDS Church would be more transparent about the fact that it did used to practice polygamy. And we talked about how maybe some of the young people learn about things in Mormon history that they haven't heard about at church, but then they learn about on Google. This is one of them. There are some young LDS members of the church who grow up and they've never heard that Joseph Smith practiced polygamy or inaugurated polygamy, and then someone tells them or they learn it on the internet, and it's so shocking to them that it shakes their faith, and that's just ridiculous.
What's the rate of loss? How many people opt out of the church in a given year? Would you guess?
I don't know.
The church keeps those statistics pretty close to the vest, and the church might not even know the full extent of it because people might just kind of disappear. And the church is very good at keeping records of all kinds, but it is hard to say. But I agree with Jana that anecdotally it seems that there is a real problem of attrition. I mean, that's true of any religious body, but there does seem to be something going on right now, as has been reported recently.
I could also share something that I've learned only quite recently. Because Mormons do not practice polygamy, I'm not terribly aware of the polygamous practices of other groups except from what I read in books. And one of the things that I came across recently was very interesting. This person said that the media has grossly exaggerated the number of fundamentalist offshoot groups that do practice polygamy. The size of those groups altogether may be more like 20 or 30,000 people combined, which, you know, when you look at something like the show Sister Wives or Big Love, you think that maybe this is more prevalent than it actually is among the fringe groups. And it's important to try to keep this in perspective.
I was going to point out the point that Patrick just made, and you too, Janet, in terms of transparency. I mean, the church isn't transparent about these figures, but do you think that they should be more transparent? Is transparency about numbers such as this? Is that important data?
Well, the LDS Church doesn't have any reason to be transparent about other groups' numbers, and the LDS Church is not practicing polygamy now. But I think that the LDS Church does need to be more transparent about its own past mm-hmm. and the polygamy that was practiced no. before 1890.
And what about attrition and retention? Is that important information in your eyes?
Oh, I see. I'm sorry, I misunderstood your question. Yes, I think it would be very helpful if we had more information about how many people are leaving, why they're leaving, and how much of that is related to the larger demographic trends in America that I referenced earlier, and how much of it is unique to Mormonism.
I want to read you an interesting email I've got in front of me. And I'm interested in how all three of you might respond to this. This fellow says, "Hello, Milt, another fine program." I thank him for that. Then he goes on to say, "I have to wonder just why people need to identify God all the time. That's like trying to identify and give a face to air. All people have to go on are stories handed down, stories that are changed around, magnified, diluted to someone's liking. I am a recovering Catholic, and I wish I had never gone through what I did. I feel that Jesus was a prophet, and that's about it, just like all the other prophets in time. If a person can live a good, wholesome life through a belief system, that's fine. But to have to try to prove things that are basically metaphors is beyond me. No one has experienced what they preach. Experience is knowledge. Everything else is only data. Keep up the good work, David, in someplace in Illinois."
You know, that reminds me of a conversation I had a couple of weeks ago with another reader. I mean, I would say that, you know, he talks about experience and knowledge. I cover religion, so I cover belief, and that's, you know, what is preached. And so I don't know that there's a need to prove or, but anyway, the conversation that I had a couple of weeks ago was with a reader who took issue with journalists who interview people. "Why did you do it?" "Well, God told me to." Or "Why do you think that person was saved?" "Well, you know, God made sure that it was." And he said, "Quit letting them get away with that, with attributing it to God." And I saw his point, and I think that it's important for journalists to probe that a little bit more and to ask, "What do you mean by that? Why do you think that? Why do you believe that?" But I also think it's a valid belief that shouldn't be ignored or overlooked. And so it was an interesting point, and the reader definitely made me, you know, think about that. But yeah, I don't know if Jana and Patrick have any thoughts on that.
Let us instantly inquire. What we have there is a general complaint by somebody formerly committed, in this case, to Catholicism, but now is finding all of it merely metaphorical, and he can accept, I gather, the moral content and the spiritual aspiration, but beyond that, he cannot take any particular narrative of Christianity, including, I'm sure, Mormonism, seriously.
Well, I don't have the great metaphysical answers that perhaps that person is looking for, except to point out that the language that this person used, David, I think it was,
yes,
is very much in keeping with the language of the nuns, mm-hmm. you know, the group of disaffiliated Americans that I was talking about. The idea that no one religion has a monopoly on truth is, you know, a very important idea to this group. And the idea that there are many different paths is very important.
I think, you know, the language that he used about experience and knowledge and so forth, it's interesting to me because Mormons use that kind of language all the time. But for them, it's a different kind of it's a spiritual form of knowledge. And Mormons really emphasize the fact that they have the right to receive revelation. It's not just the prophet that receives revelation, but individual Mormons can pray and be inspired by the Holy Ghost and receive revelation from God. And of course, you know, that can lead down all kinds of dangerous paths, as we've seen through history. But for ordinary Mormons, that means God told me to go help this widow. God told me to, you know, to go check in on somebody. You know, God told me to be a more loving husband. You know, those are the kinds of gentle pastoral messages that the Mormons get from God as they seek revelation. But for Mormons, it is about direct experience with God. And I think that's really at the heart of Mormon theology and experience.
Speaking of Mormon theology, what does Mormon theology specify as to the post-corporeal existence of non-Mormons, particularly of other Christians, or for that matter of Jews, or for that matter Buddhists, Hindus, or what have you?
You know, the book American Grace that I talked about a moment ago one of the questions asked of members of all of these different faiths was, will members of other faiths go to heaven? Will they be in your heaven? And Mormons actually came out with 98% response that other members of other religions and members of no religion will be in heaven. And that's because Mormonism doesn't have this kind of all-or-nothing idea of the afterlife, that there's heaven and then there's hell. In Mormonism, there are degrees of glory. That's what it's called. Essentially, almost everybody inherits some kind of paradise. And depending on how you have lived your life as a person of integrity, that has a lot to do with where you wind up.
Now, can a non-Mormon male, through ages and ages of perfection in the afterlife, ascend ultimately to becoming God, just as our God was once a man and became God?
Not in the classic formulation.
You've got to be a Mormon to become God. You've got to be a Mormon to become God.
I wouldn't necessarily use those words. Yeah. Patrick, what were you going to say?
Well, I was going to say, you know, that could happen, as Jana explained earlier, with baptisms for the dead and this other proxy work that Mormons do. It doesn't have to be that people have to be Mormon here on Earth. It's part of this very expansive salvation story that is revealed to Joseph Smith, that actually everybody has ever lived on Earth, according to Joseph Smith, this offer of salvation, exaltation, even godhood is available to everybody, whether or not they were a baptized Mormon here on Earth.
So they become Mormon in the afterlife on their way to becoming God.
That's right.
All right. We pause the last round of commercials, then directly back with more calls.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we go directly back to the phones in just a moment. But first, a quick commercial for ourselves. Every so often, we want to remind you that every program you hear here can be heard again in podcast form at our regular website. That is wgnradio.com/extension720. Tonight's program will be up by tomorrow. Just as our last program, A Night at the Opera, the Lyric Opera, is now available, and you can hear that discussion and a lot of great recorded music that we played as well. Also, we've got many so-called Extension 720 classics. We've got hundreds of them literally available on the website, but on the front page, only perhaps 23 or 25. Among them, a classic conversation with Carl Sagan some years ago, a classic program on astrophysics and ultimately cosmology, one on the Byzantine culture at its height and what that life was like, Oliver Sacks, the great neurologist, literary figure, and so on. For those who grew up with this radio station, a conversation I had many years ago, 1985, with Wally Phillips, the man who was this station, and so on and so on. Henry Kissinger. We've saved this one for the front page, though it's been there for quite some while now, and much else. And, of course, if you just hit where it says More Archives, you literally go to other pages that give you hundreds and hundreds of classic programs that we're rather proud of and that you can download or listen to on a streaming basis. And with that, we will go directly back to the phone lines, 312-591-7200, and Charlotte now is with us. Good evening.
Hi. The golden plates that inspired the Book of Mormon, Joseph Smith to write the Book of Mormon, where are these golden plates today?
Very interesting question.
After Joseph Smith finished his translation of the Book of Mormon, the angel Moroni that had showed him where the plates were took the plates back, and so we don't have the plates with us today.
And they were written in what he called Old Egyptian, and he somehow had the gift of translation.
That's right, and he always said, when people asked him, how did you translate him, he simply said, by the gift and power of God. It wasn't a translation in the sense that we think of it. He didn't know this Egyptian language. He oftentimes wasn't even actually looking at the plates. It was a process of revelation more than translation in the sense of using a dictionary or something like that, he dictated the words of the Book of Mormon.
How offended would you be if I say directly what I really believe, namely that he's a great and fascinating figure in religious history, but that essentially he wasn't lying, but that came out of his own confabulatory invention? He experienced this and believed it to be true, but it was not. true. It came from his own. Indeed, you find in what he says, even in the scriptural form, you find evidence of some of his own Masonic background, and you find evidence of the local culture up there in upstate New York, that this is a production of out of the full rich psychology of a most unusual man, rather than the gift through the angel Moroni of sacred scripture. How do you honestly react to that when I say it?
I personally am not offended at all, and lots of non-Mormons, that's how they've reckoned with Joseph Smith, and for many that's a charitable characterization rather than just saying he's an outright fraud. I mean, I personally believe, and I'm a believer, and I think it did come from God, but I also think one of the fascinating things about Joseph Smith is that he was always trying to latch on onto language and symbols to express his experience with God. And so, yes, he drew from Masonry, he drew from the language of evangelical Christianity, he drew from all these kinds of symbols and resources from around him, but I think what came out is really a unique and innovative and inspiring cosmology and theology. So I believe it comes from God, but a lot of non-Mormons say it comes from a fertile religious imagination. I'm not offended by that at all.
Jenna?
No, definitely not either. I think I mentioned I'm the only Mormon in my family, so this is not new to me. It is a question of faith, and I think Patrick is right that your assessment of Joseph Smith is actually quite a bit more generous than some people would allow for him. And admittedly, he is a controversial figure. Mm. There is a certain amount of faith that is involved in believing in the Restoration.
Well, you know, I should tell you, I'm a psychologist by identity and by now emeritized from the University of Chicago. And one of the courses I have taught on and off over the years is the psychology of religion. Mm. And indeed, every place you look in the history of religion, you find these extraordinary figures of charismatic quality who have great imaginative, visionary experience, which very often can alter the whole course of religion. One might even say that it's quite possible that Jesus was of that quality, though that would be perhaps more offensive to Christians who want to believe that he is, in fact, the Son of God and will come again.
And we have to remember also that in the Christian faith, more generally, Mormonism being one part of that, that, you know, we believe in a resurrected being. We mm-hmm. believe that Jesus Christ was resurrected from the dead. Really? How rational is that? We believe in a virgin birth. How rational is that? I mean, we're taking a lot of things on faith already as Christians, those of us.
Well, the comfortable way to handle that is that's another way of knowing. Science is one way of knowing. Mm. And in epistemological terms, visionary experience has equal significance or equal value as a way of knowing. I don't really believe that, but I know that lots of people do, and that's a way of handling that problem. Let's go quickly back to the phones, 312-591-7200. And next up is Ken. Good evening, sir.
Yeah, good evening, and this is for your guest panel. I was wondering when when Mormons go on missions, say, for example, to central part of Africa or northern part of Africa, do they go with medical supplies try to help the community in some way, or is it just solely an evangelical type mission?
There are several different types of missions to which people are called in the LDS Church. One of them, the one that is most instantly recognizable as the sort of two young people out on bicycles, that's called a proselytizing mission, and that one is almost solely the knocking on the doors and distributing scriptures and trying to get people to think about religion. But there are other kinds of mission as well. The LDS Church sends out humanitarian missionaries. Sometimes these are retired doctors and nurses. Sometimes they're just people who are interested. My first bishop in the church was a veterinarian, and he and his wife went on such a mission when he was retired, and she was a nurse as well. So that happens as well. I think that the LDS Church, which has given more than $1 billion in humanitarian aid since the humanitarian fund was founded in 1985, you know, it does a lot. It could do a lot more. There's so much more that could be done.
And there are some
places. And I just have one more thing to add. Patrick, I believe I may have met your wife at the Nevada game. During a football game at Notre Dame over there, we talked at length and had a great conversation with her. I believe you had a few kids. She had a few kids with her there, too. But really enjoyed the conversation with her.
And we thank you, sir, for the call. I didn't quite get all of that. Did you, Patrick?
No, I think he had run into a Mormon at Notre Dame, which is great. That's my old stomping grounds. And I was going to say I lived in Egypt for 2 years, and there were no proselytizing missionaries allowed in Egypt. That's true of most Muslim countries. But the church did have humanitarian missionaries there, and they just did wonderful work. A really, really impressive retired couple that just gave themselves full time to doing humanitarian work for the people of Egypt.
Last question, speculative, but appropriately speculative. Imagine that Romney wins, or imagine that he loses. What difference does it make? Wins the nomination, but then wins the presidency, is what I mean. What difference does it make whether our next president is Mitt Romney or is not?
Well, politically, it makes a big difference to me, because I would like to continue Barack Obama's policies in the next administration. But as far as Mormonism is concerned, I think either way, it's a tremendous opportunity for the LDS Church, first of all, to get itself out there, to try to disprove some of the stereotypes, which is what we've been doing tonight. And I really appreciate the opportunity, by the way. Thank you so much for having us on your show.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
Well, thank you. And I also think, win or lose, it shows this diversity that exists within the LDS Church. I think sometimes the temptation on the outside is to see it as a monolith, but if you remember always that it's the church of Mitt Romney and Harry Reid, that's a good thing.
A point well made, yes. Last comment from Patrick Mason, please.
I think it's an opportunity to show once again just how expansive the boundaries of American tolerance are. I mean, you know, 100 years ago, Jews and Catholics were vilified in this country, and now we talk about Judeo-Christianity, and we've had a Catholic president. Nobody even winces at the fact that Newt Gingrich and Rick Santorum are Catholic.
Uh-huh.
And I think this just shows the logic and the power of American liberalism and tolerance and pluralism. I think Mormonism will be accepted into the mainstream, if not now, sometime. I think it'll happen for Islam as well. It just shows how remarkably expansive this country is.
Patrick, thank you very much. And Jana, thank you. And Manya, thank you. It's been an exceptionally interesting conversation, I think. And we are just about out of all time.